Blog Talk Radio.
Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down.
Welcome to Southern Sense, which is common sense, and we won't tolerate any nonsense. So tune in and stand by.
Good afternoon. You're listening to another Tuesday episode here of Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Ann, the radio chick, and I'm waiting for my co-host, Cool Mike, to join us. You know he's always running around somewhere back and forth. And our guest today is going to be the Reverend Wayne Perryman of Seattle, Washington. He is a minister. He is also a scholar and author. He has also been a talk show host. He's got several books out there that we will discuss, and I'd like to welcome aboard. Welcome, Reverend Perryman. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on your show today.
And we do have Cool Mike here on with us. Good afternoon, Mike.
Hi. How are you doing today?
All right. You're running around back and forth somewhere again. You there, Mike? Okay, we may have lost him. It sounds like he was in his car. Reverend, tell me us a little bit about your background, because I was reading all of your material, and you've got a rather extensive and wide one.
Well, I have been involved in the community here in the Seattle area for several years, from coaching sports to working with gang members to helping the less fortunate. From a professional side, I have worked as the human resource director for three separate billion-dollar corporations and a national human relations consultant with a specialty in employment law for many of the Fortune 500 companies and for the various government agencies. Have about 26 books out, ranging from theology to history to children's storybooks. Last five books are political science books, and my children's books are in the Baseball Hall of Fame for the work that I do with professional athletes.
Wow. I didn't know that in the Baseball Hall of Fame. That is fantastic. You have a new book out. Let me get the title of it. Just bear with me. I got about a stack of it. The new book is The Drama of Obama, but you recently sent to the White House your other book, Whites, Blacks, and Racist Democrats. I found that fascinating.
The Drama of Obama was a book that Chairman Benjamin Jealous of the NAACP rated as thought-provoking and insightful. We went from that book. That book was written in response to Barack Obama's March 18, 2008 speech that he gave after he denounced the Reverend Wright. And then we decided that we would expand the book and revised it, add more information on it about the history of Obama's party, and we entitled that book Whites, Blacks, and Racist Democrats, The Untold History of Race and Politics Within the Democratic Party from 1792 to 2009.
And how has that been received so far?
Very well. No criticism on either of the books. They both have from a 4.5 to 5-star rating on Amazon.com.
All right, that was my next question. Where would people go to get any of your books? I know you have your own personal website.
Right, WaynePerryman.com. They can order it there, or they can order it directly from Amazon.com.
All right, because I do have up on our show page your website that people can click on, where it says click on, check out his website. That is your link to your website so people can look at it to see your books. And we do have Cool Mike back on the line. Mike, you with us today?
I certainly am. Sorry about that. I had some difficulties. So I'm doing some listening, so I'll jump in shortly. Okay, Annie?
Okay. Now, Reverend, you were telling me recently you were just on Sean Hannity this past week, and you got into it with another guest defending the Tea Parties. It seems that happens to be the Democrats' mantra lately, find some way in which to put down the Tea Parties, call it names or whatever, but to demonize it.
Well, what's sad about the Democratic Party is that they cannot really discuss issues because they have a very poor track record when it comes to issues. So the only thing that they can do is play the race card. They'll look for every opportunity to call conservatives, Republicans, or Tea Party members racists, because that's the only thing that they have to argue with when it comes to the economy, when it comes to immigration reform, when it comes to social issues like abortion, gay rights, separation of church and state, and other kinds of things. They cannot argue, they cannot have a meaningful debate because their track record in these areas are very, very poor. So what they look for to divert the conversation or the discussion is that they look for things to blame others as racist when they are historically the biggest racist institution in the entire world. Even the Nazi Party is not second, not ahead of the Democratic Party. History tells us that the Nazi Party got their leads or got their guidelines from the Democratic Party of America in looking at eliminating Jews.
Now, you have a lawsuit out right now in the Western District of Washington in the Seattle court. It's yourself, you named your mother who has passed on, and Lieutenant Colonel Francis Rice, on behalf of all African-American citizens. And this complaint is against President Barack Obama as leader of the Democratic Party and the Democratic Party. Now, you tried this once before and was dismissed. Am I correct?
Right. Not this particular case. I didn't have the plaintiff Francis Rice, nor did I name my mother as a plaintiff. And we did not name Obama as a defendant. So this case here is much stronger because we have plaintiffs who could stand the legal test of standing, and we have the President of the United States, Barack Obama, as a named defendant in this case.
All right, but you is that the main difference, or are you actually naming specific injuries because of the plaintiffs?
Well, what we're going for is an apology. We're not going for damages or any monetary damages. We're just going for a public apology. So when we look at the issue of racism and how it affected African Americans from slavery through Jim Crow, then every African American who originated out of the South, Jim Crow South, can be considered as an injured party.
All right. Now, I actually read the entire brief from cover to cover, and I finished the last pages about an hour ago. In the interim, I was also watching the movie Birth of a Nation, and I forgot that thing is so long. And my memory of it as a child and as now watching it as an adult is so different. And teaching history has been so, excuse the language of it, bastardized, that people watch a movie like this and take it as if it's the truth compared to what the actual events of the time were. And you named specifically in your brief, The Birth of a Nation movie, as being one of the causes. Can you expound on that?
Well, the Birth of a Nation was to demonize blacks as though they were out after white women, and the Ku Klux Klan had to come and save the nation from the black takeover and their pursuit of white women, making them victims. It was part of the philosophy of the Democratic Party's political agenda to keep blacks in their place and to never let them rise to prominence or a place of power within the American structure. So they did several things in addition to the movie The Klansman, The Making of a Nation, and the stage play The Klansman. And they passed legislation, and they were behind Jim Crow, black codes, and opposed every piece of civil rights legislation that was introduced into Congress for the past 150 years. Prior to that time, they were the pro-slavery components that challenged the legislation that the colonists produced back in the 1600, the anti-slavery pieces of legislation that the colonists produced, 1688 and 1711, even before we became a nation. So what we're trying to show is the collective efforts of the Democratic Party to keep blacks in their place, and that the fact that even today they have an anti-black agenda.
Now, you had mentioned 1688, and what a lot of people don't realize that in Germantown, Pennsylvania, in 1688, it was the first place in the, what would now become the United States to outlaw slavery. And in 1787, in the Constitutional Convention, the Constitution almost was not written because the northern states wanted to outlaw slavery while the southern states wanted to keep it. So a compromise was made and basically said, hey, listen, we can't deal with this at this moment because if we do, the nation will never be born. So we're going to have to compromise and kick the ball down the road, as they say, today, and deal with it in the future because we know it has to be dealt with in the future. Is that correct?
Well, the history, which they're not teaching our children, and the Democrats don't want them to teach this history, nor does Barack Obama. It's easy to blame all white people for racism in America. What they fail to show is the number of white people, both in the South and the North, who oppose racism, who oppose slavery, and many died fighting the institution of racism and slavery as well. There were 184,000 teenagers that fought in the Civil War. The Underground Railroad was not just a northern system. There were southern whites who participated in the Underground Railroad. Our history is a very racist history because it wants to brand every white person in America as racist, and it doesn't recognize the multitude of whites who fought against racism and fought against the institution of slavery. We find that Lincoln's greatest speech was not the Gettysburg speech, but his speech, A Nation Divided, which was showing or reflected the fact that this nation was always divided over the issue of race. White families split, white churches split, white denominations split, and then eventually our nation split, and we had the Civil War. But the Civil War was not a war of just the North and the South, because there were Northern Democrats who opposed Lincoln, and for instance, the riots in New York in July of 1863 went on for 5 or 6 days, where the Northern Democrats were lynching blacks on street light poles, burning down their homes, and beating and shooting them to death on the streets of New York. So it wasn't really a northern-southern thing as much as was a political thing. One party supported racism and slavery. The other party was against it. And you had whites on both sides of the issue. But that's not what we get in our history books. We get in our history books that America was racist and that all the racism was in the South of whites. Yes, a lot of it took place there, but there were whites in the South who died on behalf of blacks defending their right to be citizens of this country. So we need the true history of America, not just a biased history that covers up what the Democratic Party did in inflaming racism in America and supporting Jim Crow and the institution of slavery.
Yeah, Wayne, I have a question for you. This is Cool Mike here, co-host. I have to disagree, because if you listen to Oberman and Rachel Maddow,
oh,
Jesse Jackson, and all these high-profile people who speak, you know, how people like Annie and myself and Hannity and all of them, you know, just all the spiel that they've been doing for years and years, not just on MSNBC, but other ones, who brand people who have different views, not to mention somebody who thinks like yourself or someone else who is of who is Negro, who has a conservative view. You guys are called Uncle Toms.
Well, the reason why you disagree with me, Mr. Cool, is because Rachel Maddow is your girlfriend.
Oh, you deserve that, man. Mike. You baited him, he got you. That was very good reference.
That was a low blow, Perry. That's a low blow. I actually wrote her an email and regarding something. And all she wrote back is, there are other stations. I mean,
well, you know, the problem is that they continue this race issue. Not that racism is still not a problem in America. It's not to the degree that it has in the past, but it's the fact that they don't tell the truth about our history. For instance, in my book, Whites, Blacks, and Racist Democrats, I tell the audience, now, when you look at history, you'll find that blacks weren't able to vote. Neither were women able to vote. So when it comes to ratifying or passing the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment to end slavery, to make blacks citizens, and give them the right to vote, it was two-thirds of Congress that voted for these amendments, and Congress are made up of white men. And this was the first time that the issue of slavery was really presented to Congress after there was a two-party system. And it was two-thirds of the white men in Congress that voted for these three constitutional amendments. And it was three-fourths of the white men in all the states that ratified this the three constitutional amendments. Because women couldn't vote and ethnic minorities couldn't vote. But while they condemn white men as being racist, as being the people who was behind all of this, what they don't qualify and say, it was the white men that belonged to the Democratic Party. Because when the white men had the first opportunity to vote in Congress on the issue of abolishing slavery, they overwhelmingly voted to abolish it. White men did. But are they going to teach that to the children? No, they try to make it sound like the white man is the villain and the white man created all the racism. But, I mean, even when you look at the total history, you discount the fact that the Indians owned slaves and blacks in America owned slaves. They weren't the major slave owners, but they did indeed own slaves. There in North Carolina and South Carolina, there were some wealthy blacks that owned slaves. And so the institution, and there were some blacks that fought on the Confederate side, not a lot, but there were, and there were some Indians that fought on the Confederate side, Indians that owned the slaves. My family was owned by the Creek Indians out of Georgia, and they migrated to Oklahoma. And so the Perryman name does not come from white slave owners. It comes from the Creek Indians who were slave owners. So, but they're not going to teach this in our class because in history, because if you teach that, maybe people will have a greater appreciation for one another and the sacrifices that different ethnic groups made for one another. And maybe we start living together instead of labeling entire race as people as racist.
Well, and I think that another thing that you brought up, Mr. Perryman, that's so accurate. Many of these people who I just mentioned, they make their living on keeping everything in flames. If the fire goes out, so too does their way of life and their way of living.
And their relevancy, disappears, and the element of importance. That's why now, you know, they kind of want to switch, because more people are finding out about the racism in America comes from the left, comes from the Democrat side. Now they want to switch the issue to gay rights and call everybody homophobes.
You notice how they have to label us all into some sort of a class. Every one of us has some sort of a class. For example, I'm a white female. Mike, you're a Lebanese American. Reverend, you're considered an African American. If you can keep them labeled in those little classes, you can keep them separated. And as long as you keep them separated, you can create issues between each group and therefore maintain control over all the groups.
Those names are not as damaging as the name calling that they place on people, calling people like me Uncle Toms. It's okay for them to call me African Americans, but the term Uncle Tom, the term homophobia, the term racist, those are devastating words that really divide. But to call a person a white person or a black person or African American or Lebanese American, that's not as divisive as the term racism, homophobe, and Uncle Tom, and white nigger, and all of these other. Those are very negative names that they place on people that nobody wants to wear that label. But, I mean, you don't have a problem being labeled as a woman or a white woman because that's what you are. I don't have a problem being labeled as black. That's what I am. But to put the other kinds of name-calling on people, they're like little bully kids on a playground that's losing in the academic arena, and they're not getting good grades. So the kids that get good grades, they're going to call them names. They call this boy fatty, going to call this boy, this girl stupid or freckle face. And that's what the Democrats do. They engage in name-calling because they can't have meaningful discussions because they're not intelligent enough or their position is not good enough to defend.
You bring up a point where Herman Cain had a radio show before he went for this run of president. And I was listening to him at one time, and he put it correctly. He said a liberal, whenever you get into a debate with them, will sin. It's three things they do when they get into a debate, which ends up into an argument. First, when they find they're losing, they'll switch the subject. And when they still can't get you to lose your temper or the argument, they will then ignore the facts and just make them up as they go along. And when that even fails to work, the last thing they do will name call. And somewhere along the way, they're going to bring up Hitler, they're going to bring up racism, they're going to call you a Nazi. And, you know, every time I get into an argument with a liberal progressive, it always ends up, and I just count. And I start counting down, going, here we go, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Yep, there we go, racist. I knew they were going to do it somewhere, and right there they hit you with it. And so,
well, they're childish. They're childish. It's just like another kid that can't win a debate, like I said, on a playground. They'll call the other kid, you stupid. They'll find something that they can say that's derogatory, demeaning, and hurtful simply because they're not intelligent enough to engage in a conversation. And my lawsuit just wants to bring out the truth to America. Look, you guys have been supporting a party that has a history of racism like you cannot believe when you look into their history. As a matter of fact, when we filed this lawsuit, something strangely happened. On the Democrats' website, they changed their history. There was a time when you click on history on their website, and they would say that they started in 1792 with the Jeffersonians. Now, the earliest date recorded in their history on their website is 1930. They wiped out 138 years of history. They don't want people to know their history. And that's what this lawsuit is all about. This lawsuit, in essence, it is to support and honor those whites who gave their lives for black people, who fought and lost their homes and their farms and their children and their lives in defending their black brothers and sisters. That's really what our history tells us. And who were they fighting? They were fighting those people who bought into the Democrats' racist agenda. Those people need to be honored. There is not a statue, to my knowledge, of the 400 monuments in Washington, D.C., honoring those people, the abolitionists, and those people who fought on behalf of their black brothers and sisters and actually died. And so this lawsuit is just trying to bring some sense to say that there's another side of our story of black and white relations in America that they're not telling in our colleges, in our schools. And they even have professors that read my book and say, you know, you bring out some interesting facts that I never considered or thought of before.
You have on the, as I said, I did go through and read this. When you were mentioning their past history, on page 4 of it, in section 7, going on to page 5, you go down point by point of all the things that they have done as a Democratic Party since 1792, opposing the abolitionists, what we've been describing, supporting slavery and fought to expand it, supported and passed the Fugitive Law Act of 1793, supported and passed the Missouri Compromise, which was just a way of keeping the Union together a little bit longer before.
Well, to expand slavery into the northern states, that was their strategy. And rather than saying, there'll be no more slave states, they said, okay, let's say that one state would have to be, when they come in, one would have to be slave, one would have to be free. I mean, they were arguing so that they can expand slavery with the Missouri Compromise and the same thing with the Kansas-Nebraska Act. It was their method of expanding slavery.
Right. And Texas was a big, big chunk of land they didn't want to lose. And that's one of the reasons why they came up with that. You also have, they backed the Dred Scott decision. You want to explain that one?
Well, you know, the courts had determined that Dred Scott was not really a person. He was property, and therefore the pro-slavery persons in the South could reclaim their slaves as their property, just like they could reclaim a mule or a chicken or a wagon or any type of piece of equipment. They sort of degraded the black man to make him property and not a person. So they were behind that. But what's even further is the fact that the Democrats stacked the U.S. Supreme Court with pro-slavery justices. That's how they were able to get the kind of decisions at the Supreme Court level. If you look at the appointees of those justices during the time that these decisions were made, they all were appointed by Democratic pro-slavery politicians.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah, this one I was not aware of until I read that section, because when you were discussing the Dred Scott decision here, that was on page 20 of your brief. Five of them were Democrats appointed by President Andrew Jackson, and you named those five. The other four members of the court, including Taney, were from slave-holding states. But from 1790 to 1861, except for a few years in the 1830s, you're right, the majority of the Supreme Court justices were Southerners. And even the Northerners that were on the court were Democrats who voted with their pro-slavery Southerners. So
I mean, this is a history they're not going to tell you in school. And this piece of information about the Supreme Court comes from a huge, thick book. It's about close to 1,800 pages that was written by 350 legal scholars on the Supreme Court, talking about the history of the Supreme Court. And these are both Democrat and Republican scholars. And this is just one portion of the book as they talked about the makeup of the Supreme Court during this period of American history. And so this is not something that Wayne Perryman has come up with or some right-wing Republicans or some white conservatives. This is information that's produced by 350 legal scholars that are both Democrat and Republicans.
And that book is, that's the one I believe is called the Oxford Companion?
Absolutely.
Mr. Perryman, I have a question. How come when, whether it's television or writing an article in a newspaper, how come certain people, like the people I had mentioned before in the media, how come certain people can get away with saying so much, to whereas if, you know, a white person said it, next thing you know, I mean, this person, such as, you know, going throughout history, Jimmy the Greek and Andy Rooney, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it just seems like Jesse Jackson and many others have said much more hurtful, mean, just vindictive, contempt-type statements, but it's just, oh, that's how we accept them.
Well, you know, the problem is that when you don't know your history, they can get away with those kinds of things. Many of those people will not debate me because they can't change history. When I give a given fact of history, they can't twist that up. I mean, history is history. What happened, happened. And they're able to get away with it because the average American do not know their history. They only know the distorted parts that liberal professors and liberal high school teachers provide for our kids today, and so they're able to get away with this outlandish statements that they make. Now, you take like Reverend Wright, until he was caught, he was getting away with that for a number of years, and Obama was following him, but there was too much media that exposed that by the conservative media that they had to just go ahead and deal with that. But Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, those guys come from the Democratic South. Dr. King, they know that they never would vote Democrat when they lived in the South. No way. They all voted Republican. And so, and the reason why is because they knew how they were treated by the Democrats of the South. They knew the policies from 1877 to 1977. This is right after Reconstruction. Every southern state was controlled by Democratic governors, a 100-year period. Every southern state in that 100-year period had Democratic governors, with the exception of one had one-term Republican in Florida, another had one-term Republican in Oklahoma. But all the others in that 100-year period, every last one of them were Democratic governors. So everything that took place in the South, from segregation to separate restrooms and separate drinking fountains and segregated schools, those were the policies of the Democrats. And Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton knows that. But yet, since most of our young people don't know that history, they only know the history from Martin Luther King forward, that they're able to say things and get away with things. And to be honest, Republicans don't challenge them. They sit down and they take it, and they will not debate with them. When I was debating on the Sean Hannity show last week with Professor Lamar Hill, I mean, he had to admit Yes, I agree with you, Reverend Perryman. The Democrats do owe blacks an apology. But prior to that time on that show, he was trying to defend the Democrats.
So but who would you...
He could not debate with me because he does not have the research or the in-depth history that I have. There's very few people in the country besides David Barton, and I know things about history that David Barton doesn't know. But there's very few people in America that knows the American history in terms of race relations than I do. That's why professors won't argue with me. They won't debate with me.
They probably won't have you on their show either because you obviously have such a good grasp. Reverend, I got another question. Throughout history, who would you say, I think it's fair to assume that you're somewhat of a very good a professor of black studies, who would you say are some of the presidents in U.S. history that have really tried to make strides in helping the black community be helpful to themselves? And who would you say, like, are some of the most detrimental? Just name a couple throughout history. Because I don't know history very well. So I depend on people like historians like yourself, and we have a very smart person on Blog Talk, Dr. Jones, for history. So who would you say two or three presidents of really positive and two or three very negative? And let's pull Barack Obama out of the topic because we know how bad he is.
Well, definitely I would say Lincoln and Grant were the two who were the strongest ones. Some of the worst ones were Andrew Johnson that took over after Lincoln because he tried to veto everything, and then all the way up to Franklin D. Roosevelt, who was forced to do the few things that he did. But he and his wife, Eleanor Roosevelt, didn't even sleep in the same bed because Eleanor was very, very strong and very, very supportive of blacks. Franklin thought that she just went too far and said, "You're going to make me lose my southern constituency by your support of blacks." And the reason why blacks started voting for Franklin Roosevelt was because of Eleanor, not because of Franklin.
Now, I find it interesting because in this whole brief everything, Andrew Johnson pops up a lot. And ironically, in John F. Kennedy's book he wrote prior to becoming a senator, Profiles in Courage, he cites Andrew Johnson standing up against the Congress when they were trying to override his vetoes. And they tried to impeach him at one point, tried to remove him from office.
Yeah,
and
he stood up against Congress because Congress was overriding his vetoes and those vetoes dealt with civil rights issues for blacks. That's why he was being impeached.
Mm-hmm.
And so by Kennedy supporting Andrew Johnson and Andrew Johnson's right to veto, he was vetoing, you know, the 1866 Civil Rights Act. He attempted to veto the 1867 Reconstruction Act. So he was trying to veto legislation that the Republican Congress had passed. And the reason why they were able to pass the legislation is that the southern states that seceded from the North or from America were still out. They had not come back yet. So the Congress was dominated by Republicans. And the only people who were Democrats that remained there were the Northern Democrats, and they didn't have the power to outvote the Republicans on these issues that came before Congress, the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment, 1866 Civil Rights Act, and the 1867 Reconstruction Act. Johnson, after Lincoln died, tried to veto those pieces of legislation, and he couldn't because he didn't have enough members of Congress, so he had to try to get as many of the Southern delegates back into Congress after Reconstruction so he would have more power to override the civil rights legislation that was being passed by Republicans.
Yeah.
So why would Kennedy want to praise him? It's the same reason why Kennedy did not want to interfere with the matters of Dr. Martin Luther King, because Kennedy said he would lose the Southern vote. And he advised his staff, no matter what happens to Dr. King, don't speak out against it, don't help Dr. King, don't get involved with that, because I'll lose the Southern vote.
But then again, his brother went over and around him and helped him.
It wasn't his brother. It was Wilford Harris, who was a friend of Coretta Scott King and Dr. King Sr., Daddy King. He was the one that made the call, and Kennedy didn't know about it, to get Dr. King out of the Georgia jail. But when the press got a hold of it, they twisted up and said Kennedy made the call. And Dr. King's daddy actually thought that Kennedy made the call. When the word got back to Kennedy that Wilford Harris, his civil rights advisor, made the call on behalf of Kennedy, Kennedy cursed him out and threatened to fire him. But before Kennedy could take that action, he saw the response of blacks down south and Daddy King going on national TV saying they're not going to throw their support behind Nixon now. They're going to throw it behind Kennedy. Kennedy shut his mouth up and told Wilford Harris, man, I'm sorry. I thought you were going to mess up my Southern vote, but you actually helped it.
Well, now I'm going to have to look that up. That's something I was not aware of, because I did interview Judge Murray Silver, who was personal friends with Daddy King, and he wrote the book Daddy King and Me, and he talks about that incident, and he was under the assumption it was Kennedy that made the call, too.
Kennedy
never made
the call.
Because he got that directly from Daddy King.
No, that's what Daddy King thought. Wilford Harris, in his book of Kennedys and King, he after he wrote this book, he was on ABC America, he was on Fox, he was on all of the stations talking about the story and what really happened. He was the close friend of Coretta Scott King and Dr. King. They were on a first-hand, first-name basis, of Wilford Harris and the Kings. And when he made the call, the Georgia governor thought he was calling on behalf of Kennedy. He thought that Kennedy had advised him. But Wilford Harris said, no, not at all. He said, Kennedy cursed me out like a sailor. He and Robert said, you have blown our election. We lost the Southern vote.
Wow. That is a little bit of history that I'm definitely going to pick up that book, definitely. Have to read that. You also turned
It's really amazing is that myself, I don't know about you, Annie, but everything that Mr. Perryman is saying, I learned like the exact opposite in school. And it's almost a sad case of how many other just millions of people have really not been truly educated like we're hearing today, that we're just from a very young age, I don't want to say told completely the opposite, but certainly 90% of the opposite of the facts that are being presented here.
Well, the we're spending billions of dollars to indoctrinate our kids, not educate our kids. I mean, tell our kids the truth and then leave it up to their intelligence to decide which way they want to go. Do you want to support Republicans or Democrats? But don't decide for them by giving them a biased education, and you're spending billions of dollars of our tax monies not to tell our children the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
That's what's missing in education. There's no more critical thinking. You know, people are not being given a set of facts and allowing themselves to evaluate it and look at it and investigate it on their own. No one is doing critical thinking any longer.
The professors and the teachers think for them. My sons have had all kinds of problems with their professors and teachers because their dad is a scholar. Their dad, they can look at their dad's library. I have books that are long out of print, books back in the 1800s, and I have a small film library that's on history, and they can look at that. And when they debate with their teachers and friends in school, The friend said, where did you get that information? They said, well, my dad's a library. My dad's a historian. My dad has books on this and da-da-da-da. But they don't get that kind of thing in the public schools. So we're paying billions of dollars to teach our children a history where our kids come out not appreciating America, not appreciating the people who made America great. People stood up. I mean, many of these people, I'm impressed with the fact they were Christians, and they were doing it because they felt that's what the Bible told them to do. When the whites down south defended blacks, they stood up and said, the Bible says, love my neighbors. When Abraham Lincoln's father walked out of the church and grabbed Lincoln and his wife and the siblings, and they walked out of the church because their pastor was preaching a pro-slavery sermon. And Lincoln's father said, we'll never go back to that church again because the Bible don't support what our pastor was saying. I mean, but history don't give an account of these kinds of people who sacrificed, who believed in the Bible. That's why they want separation of church and state. They don't want to show the Christian influence on the good things that they did in making this one of the greatest nations on earth. So separation of church and state, they discount everything that the Christians had did, including the Underground Railroad and including anti-slavery societies and including abolishing slavery and the abolitionist movement, which was all inspired by Christian people who read the Bible differently than those people read the Bible and said it's okay to treat blacks this way. You're not going to get that in our schools.
No, because you actually turned around and went to bat against two largest of the Christian publishers. I'm going to pronounce this wrong. Zondervan's?
No,
and,
that's correct.
And the Encyclopedia Britannica. And you had them removed.
And Thomas Nelson, who's the largest Christian publisher in the world.
Oh, all right, I missed that part. You had them remove the theory called Curse of Ham.
Correct. The Curse of Ham theory was used to justify slavery and to justify Jim Crow and other racist practices by the Christians that supported that ideology. The Curse of Ham comes from the story of Noah, when one of Noah's sons supposedly did something to Noah, and as a result of that, Noah cursed him and said, you and your descendants will be the slaves or the servants of your brother. And Ham, in the biblical and the Hebrew, was supposed to be the father of the African nations, and Shem and Japheth, his brother, were supposed to be the fathers of the European and Asian nations. So the Christians interpreted the Bible that blacks were supposed to be slaves, and for 500 years they used the Curse of Ham theory to justify the mistreatment of black people from a Christian perspective. Through my research, I proved that the theory was wrong and that the Bible did not say that, and their interpretation of that scripture was totally false theology. And when the scholars of these two major Christian publishers, as well as the scholars of the Encyclopedia Britannica, read and looked at my research and had their scholars to look at it, then they all agreed that they will pull the books from the shelf and remove the Curse of Ham theory from all of their publications, including the encyclopedia.
I think you, the song that I play in the beginning where I say I won't back down, I think that was written about you, Reverend. I honestly do.
Well, the Bible says you should know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. The truth empowers us. And the reason why the Democrats don't want to know the truth, I mean, even like the issue of tax and taxing the rich, they will never come out and say that 50% of American workers don't pay any taxes at all. They will never say that 10% of the richest people in America pay 70% of the taxes. They don't want to tell the people the truth, and they'll conceal the truth. And so the truth empowers people, and it's tough to deal with the truth. I had the the NBA, that's the National Bar Association, that's the Black Bar Association that has over 20,000 black judges and attorneys in their organization. And they sort of condemned me for filing this lawsuit. And I said, how can you condemn me for filing this suit against the Democratic Party when your organization started by two black attorneys who were defending blacks against Democrats who were trying to hurt them? That's your history. Your history shows that your organization started by fighting Democrats who were trying to hurt blacks in the legal system. And yet you're going to condemn me for suing them for doing the same thing.
Yeah, that's so very true, because you have in here where Senator William Stoughton, who was a Republican from Michigan, had evidence in the debate and hearings around the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871 where they said the KKK was part of the Democratic Party. But at the time it was also called Conservative Party, which kind of like rankles me a little bit. And you have the organization sought to carry out its purposes by murders, whippings, intimidation, and violence against its opponents. They had this evidence back as far as 1871. They called it the Tammany Hall Democracy. I can't see how they can attack you over this, because from what I'm seeing on this, it's very well thought out. You cite instance after instance of documented history. Some of these things, though, that really, really bothered me when you were talking about the lynching of Sam Hose and Mary Turner. The graphic details, it's not that you included the details, but the fact these instances actually happened and the way the people acted in the crowd, I found so abhorrent that another human being would do this to someone.
Well, you know, the thing of it is that the whole terrorist organization started in the South through the Klan and the other white knights of the Klan. They were designed to keep blacks in their place and to force them to vote Democrat or not vote at all. And so that was their primary reason. But yes, they targeted white Republicans, they targeted Jews, and they targeted Catholics as well. But they certainly did not want the blacks, because they knew that when blacks voted, they were going to vote Republican. That's what happened during Reconstruction. That's when our first black senators got into Congress after Reconstruction, because blacks were able to vote in the South. And they saw the insurgents of blacks in state legislators in Louisiana and Georgia and North Carolina, that they saw the number of black elected officials went up overnight right after slavery when blacks were given the right to vote. So they had to stop blacks from voting, otherwise they would lose all of their power in Congress, and they started killing blacks. And they started every kind of system to deny blacks the right to vote. Because the 14th Amendment made them citizens, the 15th Amendment gave them the right to vote, and so they had to do something to stop that. And the Klan was just one of their ways of stopping blacks from voting, because they knew the blacks would not vote Democrat, because although many of them weren't educated, they had enough sense to know who was hurting them, and the people that was hurting them was the Democratic Party. And they knew that Lincoln was the party of Republicans, and they cited. I mean, when Lincoln died, you should have seen the tears and the outcry of blacks all over the United States. They thought that their savior had died, is what many were quoted as saying. So he was so prominent among blacks, and practically every black shack in the South and every black household in the North had a picture of Abraham Lincoln. So there's no way they were going to vote Democrat. And the only way that they, with the millions of blacks in the South, and most of the blacks, 90% of them, were still residing in the South, they hadn't all migrated to the North, most blacks migrated during World War II to the north, but the vast majority still remained in the south prior to World War II. And they knew that the blacks weren't going to vote Democrat. So the only way you could do that is start terrorist organizations, and they would ride through the black community the night before the election, burn down their homes, bring blacks out, and beat them in front of the entire community, and told them that if they voted Republican, this would happen to the rest of them. And they stood at voting polls with shotguns, and when blacks walked up to vote, they would say, if you cast a vote for the radicals, is what they call them, the Republican Party, said, we're going to kill you. And so the blacks had to vote Democrat or don't vote at all. That's why the terrorist organization was started. And the 1871 congressional hearings on the Ku Klux Klan revealed this. Klansmen testified that this was what they were all about.
Wow.
So, why then are so many blacks Democrats then?
They don't know their history. Whites don't know their history. Blacks don't know their history. They've all been educated in the public schools. And the Republican Party never have printed one book on their history. I'm one of the first persons to publish books that reflected this history. And Republicans, I mean, I was at the Republican convention in 2004. I was speaking at one of their events there in New York. And I asked one person after another, Republican leaders, I said, what's significant about this year for the Republican Party? And they thought it was just to reelect President Bush. None of them knew that that was their 150th birthday, and there was no celebration in New York at the Republican convention for their 150th birthday. They don't know their history.
Wow. Mr. Perryman, who would you basically say right now our current elected officials that you look at as not necessarily leaders of the black community, but people who are I don't know, kind of the opposite of Maxine Waters and the same old broken record that we hear
definitely
day in and day
Alan
out.
West. I mean, Alan West is a strong person. Non-elected people would be people like Star Parker and you have Shelby Steele and a number of conservative blacks out there, but they only get play from the right-wing media. They don't get any play from your girlfriend, Rachel Maddow. She won't have them on the show. Or if they have someone like that on the show, you know, they'll have a bunch of people like Bill Maher and others, about 10 of them against the one black conservative, and they'll gang up on them and won't ever really let them have their say-so. So there are a number out there. More and more are emerging. Dr. Francis Rice, who's a plaintiff in our case out of Florida, Sarasota, Florida, and many of the others around the country are starting to surface. You have Bishop Jackson down there in Georgia, and you have Bishop, what's his name, from Detroit, that ran for the Senate position, and then you have Lynn Swan, who ran for governor down there in Pennsylvania. And so there are more and more that are starting to emerge. But the media, like on my lawsuit, the major media, Washington Post, New York Times, Chicago Tribune, the L.A. Times, so none of them talked about my lawsuit.
Well, I'm glad that we were able to give you airtime on that. We also had on here Lenny McAllister. When we had a tea party, it was 2 years ago, I had gotten Lenny down here for being our guest speaker. He's someone that shows up on CNN, one of the few as a black conservative that shows up on CNN as a guest. So, I mean, people are coming out of the woodwork. We just had on just last week Stacey Swimp, who is with the Frederick Douglass Society up in Michigan. Like I said, they're coming out, and I'm.
It
heartens me.
Obama is helping too, because many of the black clergy today are really getting tired of him. I mean, they were for him originally, but now with unemployment problems and the economy that's hurting the black church and his policies on abortion and gay rights, gay marriage and civil unions and things, it's really starting to irritate a number of blacks. And they showed it in Proposition 8 in California. The black churches joining with Latino churches are the ones that made that happen. So you'll find that there are more and more blacks, and that's why you have Tavis Smiley and Professor Cornel West and Louis Farrakhan and even Cool Mike's other girlfriend, Maxine Waters, coming out and saying
you.
Things
he's
against.
Nailing you, Mike.
I just had to open my mouth now, didn't I?
We know they're sneaking in your nightclub and you're dancing with both of them. We know that, Mike.
I think we have the wrong format. Mr. Perryman, then how can they get away with just the things they say? I mean, just the horrible... I mean, right now they could call in this show and call you every name in the book, and you'd have so many people shaking their head, yeah, that's right. Why are people so dumb? I mean, what is it?
Because
I mean,
most people get their information from TV and the liberal media, and so they think it's fact. Every day when I watch people on the bus, I watch them in Denny's and Starbucks, and their nose is in the paper, and they believe everything that they read in the paper. If the paper says it's true, they believe it. And so when you have powerful papers like the New York Times, I know they're losing circulation now, and the Washington Post and some of the other liberal Chicago Tribune and L.A. Times, and when they write this stuff, the people believe it.
No,
they don't challenge it.
No, and
I believed it for a number of years, and that's why I was Democrat for a number of years, because I never read any books. I just pretty well, whatever the media said. That's why I was on the Washington State black clergy to reelect President Clinton.
We'll forgive you. We'll forgive you.
He's one of your southern boys down there. What do you mean?
Good. Stick it to her, Mr. Perryman. I've been taking it enough all show.
I can tell you, in 1976, I did not vote for Jimmy Carter, and that was the first election I voted in.
I find it really amazing that when you have an individual like Mr. Perryman and many, many other black people who basically are telling the truth, who really should be admired, because in a lot of ways, you're going to get black labeled or whatever the new term is for Uncle Tom or whatever. But the bottom line is you should really be like kind of revered as truth tellers after decades and decades of these lies, basically to, I don't know, keep a political structure in power, or I don't know exactly how to put that, but to keep that powers that be in office.
Well,
yeah, it's going to take a lot of money out of a lot of people's pockets. You know, there are people who are in the race industry and they get a lot of money. Even the unions, you know, originally they were the most racist institutions in America, and now they act like they're the friend of workers or a friend of blacks, and you know, and calling the Tea Party saying, let's get rid of these sons of, you know, and all of this kind of crap. I mean, and they're all hiding behind their racist history, and people are not calling them out.
Well, that's what you're doing now. You've teamed up with Lieutenant Colonel Francis Rice, Dr. Rice, in this lawsuit, and she's president of the National Black Republican Association, and groups like this are popping up across the United States. We've got here in South Carolina, Rowena Booker, who is in charge of the South Carolina Black Conservative Movement. I think you're going to see, come 2012, you're going to see a lot of these voices coming out of the woodwork.
Well, you know, some of the books that I've written and the fact that I'm an inner city minister and work so many years in the inner city helping the poor and helping gang members and single parents without charge, without a salary, has given many of these other people confidence to come forward, because before, you know, they considered the conservative blacks a suburban black who was removed from his community and he was influenced by white people. But they can't say that about me. And so by me coming on the scene, it has empowered those conservative blacks so that they can't label them as blacks who are out of touch with the black community, not concerned about the black community, and have been indoctrinated by whites. The fact that I represent blacks in discrimination lawsuits that attorneys turned down and the NAACP and Urban League turned down, and they have no place to go, and they come to me and I defend them, successfully defend them in lawsuits, Jesse Jackson, without charging him, Jesse Jackson and the others can't say that. And so it's tough to put the label on me because I don't get any money off of what I do. I'm on no one's payroll. I don't receive a salary from a church, never did receive a salary from a church. I was associate pastor, not the senior pastor. And so I did get a stipend of about $500 to cover my gas mileage a month. But other than that, I haven't received a salary for the work that I've done in the community. And I travel all over, and many times I travel at my own expense to Tea Party rallies, and I don't get paid an honorarium. Now, Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton can't say that. They're paid for what they do.
Yeah,
they
get paid well.
Jesse Jackson is insanely rich.
And the money, and money for this lawsuit is coming out of my pocket.
Well, then I'm going to encourage anyone and everyone out there listening, because we have people up in the chat room that have joined us. As a matter of fact, Doc Jones is up in the chat room, and he said he's on a conference call. Otherwise, he would be joining you on the phone. He's another good conservative out in Florida, has a lot of experience with this and knowledgeable in the black history. You have something very interesting, and it really struck a raw nerve in me when I was reading this, because you're talking about how your mom had raised you and how a lot of the Southern blacks were told to fear the white man, no matter who. It could have been the doctor, the minister, your best friend's, you know, parent or whatever, to fear and to distrust the white. And it struck me in a chord and brought back a lot of memories, because when I was a police officer in New York, I was in Brooklyn, and we had a large influx of Southern blacks living in the area, and there were several instances where I came across a fellow officer, and I looked at it blue as blue. You know, you all wore the same uniform. It didn't matter. And it struck me when someone turned around and said, well, your people enslaved my people. I'm not riding with you. You're not going to partner with me. And it hit a raw nerve. I'm like, what do you mean? And I said, I'm only second-generation American. None of my family was here when all this was going on. And I said, you know me. I don't have a racist bone in my body. I see a blue uniform. And all I care about is whether or not you got your back, my back, and I've got your back. That's all I care about. And we would go into these huge debates, but you don't understand. You didn't grow up black. He says, no. My grandparents were immigrants. Tell me, I grew up as an American. I don't see anything else.
Well, you know, that's the way we were raised. I mean, you had to. It made no difference. You talk about the lynching of Mary Turner and Sam Hose that I mentioned in the brief. That's just typical. They would lynch children. They would kill children that got out of the place. And the parents will always point to them and say, and they would do that just to send a signal to the black community, don't get out of your place. And the parents will always warn their kids, because they never wanted to see their kids on the end of a rope or they never wanted to see their kids brought into the public street and beaten by the white Klan. And so that fear was always there. If you talk to any blacks raised in the South, we were taught to fear because we knew these were vicious people and they would kill us. And that's what happened to Emmett Till. We tell the in our brief about Emmett Till. He stepped out of line, and because he stepped out of line, they beat the poor boy to death, tied barbed wire around his neck, and threw him in the Mississippi River. So, I mean, those kinds of things happen, and like I say in my brief, my mother was so fearful of whites that when she died, she had chain locks on her refrigerator and food cabinets because she thought that whites were sneaking her house and poisoning her food.
You were also saying that she had you check underneath the house every night to make sure there's no one underneath there listening in.
Yeah, when Mother would talk about white people and part of our, if you will, our training program on whites, she would whisper, and then sometimes she would have us to go check underneath the house to make sure that whites weren't underneath our house listening to it. She was very, very paranoid, and we thought she was crazy and insane because I was born and raised up north, and I didn't experience that. But when I started looking at the history and listening to the accounts of many blacks as I travel across the nation and hearing the stories of many blacks in the 70s and 80s, I said, my mother wasn't crazy. Many other blacks felt the same way. They did the same kinds of things. And many of the houses in the South were sort of elevated, the old shacks off the ground, because, you know, they didn't want snakes to come in, and they had to elevate a porch, and so people were able to go underneath your house and listen to you.
I can tell you that because my husband's a home inspector, and he does that all the time, go underneath the house, but not to listen in on people, I assure you.
I have a couple different topic questions than politics, for Reverend, if that's okay. Just a couple quick questions. What, like,
sure.
A little bit about you, do you have a favorite football team or a favorite, like, fast food or something a little different about you as a person?
Let's see. I like, obviously,
the Chicago Bears? Wow, so am I.
Yeah, I like the Seattle Seahawks, and I don't like Rachel, your girlfriend.
that makes two of us.
I don't like Maxine Waters. Food-wise, you know, Southern food I really like. Once in a while I have to have go and get my ham hocks and collard greens. I mean, my boys were raised up here and they had never tasted it, and you know, we didn't have a lot of that in our house as I was raising them. And so during holiday season they always said, Dad, you gotta make some macaroni and cheese, collard greens and ham hocks. I mean, it's like a holiday treat for my sons. And so I like soul food. I like Mexican food. I definitely like Chinese food. I like all kinds of music. I like very little hip hop, but the music of the 70s and 60s, I like all of the Motown sounds. I like Sinatra. I like Perry Como. I like Elvis Presley and some of his gospel stuff that he's done. I like the Letterman. I like movies, primarily court drama movies. As a matter of fact, Hollywood is looking at a movie that I wrote the script for a movie, and they're looking at maybe doing that movie. And it's a courtroom scene, as courtroom drama, as well as a race relations kind of thing. It's called Colorless Love, about a black lady trying to adopt a white child. So I like courtroom drama movies. I love the movie The Help. I thought that was a great movie. That's the last movie that I've seen recently. And I work out. I usually run about an hour or so a day. I'm in my 60s, and I did my last birthday, I did 6,700 sit-ups in an hour and 45 minutes.
Whoa.
Holy cow.
I lift over 300 pounds. And so, you know, I work out regularly. I didn't work out today because somebody from South Carolina wanted me to be on a stupid radio talk show. So I'm gonna have to go after this show ends and get a quick workout in or go down in my condo.
Annie is the queen of BTR, so I mean it's like big time. This is the next best thing to the O'Reilly factor. I won't
Light
say Hannity because we all know my opinion on Hannity. Okay, here's a religious question for you. I saw a special on TV where they showed these people fighting, like literally fighting. And it's a religious group, and they said you may think they're fighting over politics or whatever. The argument started over a biblical question, which I'll pose to you because I had never heard of this before. From a religious standpoint, do you believe when an individual dies that their soul immediately rises to heaven, or it will not rise until Jesus comes again and he takes all the souls with him? Now, mind you, these people got in fist fights over this.
Well, you know, my opinion on it is simple. Maybe I'm like George Bush. I'm just maybe like a simple country southern boy that don't want to get into all of the theological issues, although I've written books on theology. I'm advisor on one of the top-selling Bibles in the world and co-author of the African Cultural Topical Bible. But on that issue, there's some issues I say it don't make any difference. As long as I get to heaven, I'm satisfied. I'm preoccupied living on earth right now, and I need to do everything on earth so I can make it to heaven. So what happens to me afterwards is not of a grave importance to me, and you could debate that until I turn white, and it's not going to change anything. I mean, I could be right about it, I could be wrong about it, but it's not going to change the reality of whatever happens after you die is going to happen. And all the debates in the world, it's not going to change that. I just hope I can qualify to go to heaven.
Yeah, that's a great answer. While you were talking earlier, I made a call to Pontiac. I'm in Pontiac, Michigan. I go to the library quite a bit there because I like the old libraries where people kind of read and just peace and quiet, just get away from the nightclub. And they are going to order your book on Amazon within the next couple hours. She said because they're really nice about that. It seems very, very interesting. The more and more I was reading about it, the more and more I forgot, wow, he's still talking on the show. It just seems so, well, a lot of history, when you grow up thinking one thing, and people present you with facts that everything you've learned is inaccurate, that it really kind of, I don't know, throws you for a big loop. Because.
But you know what I found interesting, what really pricked my heart, honest to God, I mean, I say this all over in black and white audiences, I didn't realize how many white people died for me to be free, for me to be a citizen. I didn't have a clue. I was reading this one history professor's book that he wrote in the 1800s, and he talked about the Underground Railroad. I didn't know how many people were involved in the Underground Railroad. I heard about Harriet Tubman. But I didn't know there were thousands and thousands. He cataloged 3,011 that he was able to interview and talk with. And they included everything from the President of the United States was part of it. Many members of Congress were part of it. There were judges and lawyers that were part of it. The former president of Harvard University was part of it. They had sewing circles throughout the whole strand of the Underground Railroad that were manufacturing clothes for the slaves. They had bank accounts to draw money out, so when they reached certain locations, they got money so that they could start a new life. buy a farm and to get all the way up. I mean, it was when I start looking at this nation and the people, we're the only nation where whites fought and killed whites, whites against whites, to end the bondage of black people. I mean, John Newton there in Great Britain and England, who wrote Amazing Grace, they didn't end it by war. We're the only nation where whites killed whites to end slavery against blacks. I mean, it's an incredible, beautiful history when you really look at it. If you look at it in terms of blacks and whites, and look at what happened, I gained a great appreciation for America based upon my research, a great appreciation for those whites who sacrificed their lives, unsung heroes that no one talks about. And there were hundreds of thousands of them, not just a handful, not just John Brown, not just Thaddeus Stevens or Charles Sumner. There were hundreds of thousands of them. And that kind of thing really needs not to be hidden any longer. It needs to be brought out so it can bring us together as one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. And that can only happen when the true history is taught to our children, so that my grandchildren and great-grandchildren can grow up with yours, and regardless of their color, they embrace each other because they're American citizens and they fought by side to make this nation great. And that's what this is all about. That's what my lawsuit is all about. That's my aim. That's why I'm not asking for any money of reparation pay out of this lawsuit. Just an apology to begin the healing between the races.
Wow. How do you feel about, well, I guess I know how you feel, but when I think it was several years back, Mr. Brock, I believe his name was, he was making his tour regarding a reparations, $250,000 in gold. How do you address people who support reparations?
Well, reparations have been paid by a number of countries, not just to blacks, but other people. The Nazis had to pay some reparation to the Jews. We paid reparations to the Japanese under the Civil Liberties Act of 1988. Bill Clinton paid reparations to the blacks who were victims of the Tuskegee experiment. I think reparations, there's no problem with reparations. Reparations is just another form of compensating people for their injuries, just like a lawsuit in a car accident or a malpractice lawsuit of a doctor that either took the life of a person or caused severe damage to a person for the rest of their life. I don't have a problem with reparations. I think when people have the fear that they can be sued to compensate people for damages that they brought about, I think makes people a little bit more careful and more cautious about how they treat one another. Without that threat, I think people can become so insensitive that they'll do anything and don't have to worry about the consequences of their actions. But the reparation lawsuit on slavery was ill-directed. It should have been directed at the Democratic Party because they were behind all of the racist institutions that they're trying to get reparations from, including slavery. So I think it was ill-directed. And I think that's what the Democrats fear in this lawsuit, that if they are the ones who are labeled or directed as the people behind all of this, it could bring about a lot of lawsuits against them. But we're not asking for money. We're only asking for an apology.
Well, how would you separate the people who are descendants of slaves from those of black or African descent that now reside in the country, especially with the lack of birth records in a lot of instances?
Well, there are some people that do have birth records. Like, I trace my family back to the ownership of the Creek Indian Nations And according to the Curtis Act of 1898, we're entitled to some of the land that the Indians owned, because under the Curtis Act, it was land and property given to the Indians and their descendants and the slaves that they owned, according to the Curtis Act. It would be difficult on the issue of slavery, but under the legal test of it, there are people who can trace their ancestors back to imperial slaves. I'd say 80 to 90% of the blacks could not, but there are blacks who can. And if they wanted to pursue that, then they can. But they don't have a case against America, because America never endorsed slavery. Congress never endorsed slavery. Congress was always divided, and there was always a contingent in Congress that was constantly fighting against the institution of slavery. So slavery is never really endorsed by America as a whole. The people who were successful in getting some of the pro-slavery legislation passed, again, were Democrats.
Well,
are you pro-life, Reverend?
I don't support abortion. No, I do not. I do think that there should be some considerations of the issue of rape, because I don't think God intended anyone to bring a child into the world through rape. But overall, and people just having sex and getting pregnant, I don't believe in biological abortions, but I also don't believe in sociological abortions, that as a society we abandon the mother and the child after the child comes in the world. I think we have a responsibility to help that mother in some way so that that child could grow up healthy. If not, that child's going to be a liability to us in terms of crime and medical costs and other kinds of things. So I feel there's two types of an abortion. There's the biological abortion, and then there's the sociological abortion, and both of them can be very devastating.
Well, Reverend, it has been an absolutely fantastic afternoon. It has gone so fast. I told you it would just fly right on by. I want to really thank you so much for being with us, and I am dying to see your library, because I myself am an extensive reader, and I have my own library, which is quite eclectic, everything from Shakespeare to history to courtroom mysteries and crime mysteries and things like that. So I'd love one day to be able to visit your library and see some of your books. You are welcome back any time, and we can go on and on and on the subject
for
hours.
Well, I thank you for having me on the show. I've always wanted to find out who Rachel Maddow dated, and so I was happy to be on the show with her boyfriend.
Yeah, well, after careful deliberation after the last hour and a half, I'm going to have to fire her. Her and Maxine Waters. I just find it really amazing how, just what I said earlier, that some of these people can just say outright lies, and it's just like, if I were to say this, they would beat me down. But anyway, I also too have enjoyed this. I'm going to really enjoy reading your book, and
I'll give you
my review on it as well, Mr. Perryman.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Okay, God bless you.
God bless you too, sir, and thank you so much. All right. You have been listening to Southern Sense here on Blog Talk Radio. That was our guest, Reverend Wayne Perryman. He has a website, which is www.wayneperryman.com. Please, I implore you to go visit it and buy one of his books. He's got The Drama of Obama, and he's got The Whites, Blacks, and Racist Democrats. He also has Unfounded Loyalty, which is another book. And he wrote one on the White House unveiling the whole truth. He also has some CDs on past speeches. So please visit his website, the featured products page. I have to talk to Mike about what will happen on Friday, but I will also be hosting Tesla's show on Saturday, and we'll be talking Tea Party. So, Mike, you have any closing statements?
Actually, I do. I'd like to say this.
I am the only show on Blog Talk Radio with Playboy Bunnies announcing my show.
Yeah. Absolutely. Great guest, and as always, I really enjoyed this individual. People who tell it like it is, even despite the fact that they get quote unquote black labeled or nicknamed or whatever slur today is the popular slogan to call someone, who basically tells the truth. So with 30 seconds to go, I'll hand it to you, Annie, and we'll see you Friday. I may be a little late on Friday, but I'll be there sometime between 2 and 2:15.
All right. I'll talk to you on the phone in a little bit. So to end the show, in the words of Willie Nelson.
Turn out the lights. The party's over. They say that all good things must end. Call it a night. The party's over.